some top players today, that's kind of, I'm sorry, that's what I feel. I feel like they're not, that their prime goal is not to convey the music, it's to play the right notes. And that's kind of the fault of music in general, because that's what we've been valuing over the year, the past decade or so, is that, you know, the audition has geared people toward that. It's like, play all the right notes, be perfect, perfect playing, you know, let's make it sound like the CD. And they're not looking for the music first. They're looking for the technical things first. And I think that's wrong. I think, you know, and it, I got to say too, it makes, sometimes it makes orchestras boring.
This episode contains adult language and adult humor.
Since when have trumpet players ever been considered adults?
If you are easily offended by these types of conversations, consider switching to the oboe. Welcome to the Trumpet Guru Sang podcast. I'm your host, Jose Johnson. My guest for this episode is Phil Snedeker. Phil, well, he's all about the music. A graduate of the Eastman School of Music, Phil built a busy career performing and teaching in the greater Washington, D.C. area. He's also an accomplished composer and arranger whose etude books have become required material in many trumpet studios and is currently a trumpet professor at the Hart School. But whether it's on stage or in the classroom or through his prolific writing, Phil always wants to keep the music at the forefront. So pour yourself a big glass, pull up a chair, and let the hang begin. And welcome to another exciting episode of the Trumpet Gurus Hang. And I am joined today by Mr. Phil Snedeker. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, man. Great to be here.
It is my pleasure. You know, this is our meeting, as it were. But you've definitely been in my radar for some years. One, because of your books, and I definitely want to talk about some of the inspirations that you've had for some of the things that you've written, and the tortures that you've placed upon all of us unwitting trumpet players. But also, I didn't realize this until recently, you are the principal trumpet player for the Harrisburg Symphony, which I lived in Harrisburg for 25 years, and I'm only like 45 minutes from there now, and I have yet to see you play with the Harrisburg Symphony.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. So, for a long time, I was principal trumpet. I've recently resigned. I live in Connecticut now.
Okay.
I'm no longer doing that job, but it was a great ride. And right before COVID, Anthony DiLorenzo wrote me a 25-minute trumpet concerto called Ingenuity, which was really amazing. And it came off really well. And I did a whole multimedia thing. I did some visuals with the concerto, and we played with the orchestra, and the audience loved it. So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, cool. So you're in Connecticut now.
Yes, I teach at the Hart School, which is part of the University of Hartford. Mm-hmm. And you might be familiar with the Jackie McLean Institute that's attached to that. That's our jazz section. And then we have the classical section with Edward Cumming as our orchestra guy and Glenn Adsit as our wind ensemble guy. And it's a full-time tenure-track thing. And just this year, I got a full professor and tenure, so I can hang around until I screw up, I suppose.
because you've been at a few places over the course of your career. You're at Towson and Peabody, is that correct?
Yep, Peabody and George Mason. So those three.
Yeah. Okay.
But I was always adjunct, so I always wanted to build a studio where I'm kind of minding the store, where I have students that I'm helping along. And, you know, if your lesson's on a Monday and I see you on a Wednesday and you didn't have a good lesson on a Monday, I bring you in for 5 or 10 minutes and we talk and we maybe even do some playing. And I love the fact that I'm kind of around for these guys mostly. And as opposed to Peabody and the other ones where I would blow in one day a week and say, okay, what's your name and what are we working on, and go. Right. And then I'm driving around the Beltway like crazy person and doing all my stuff. This way I can kind of be there for them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people that are like, you know, I don't want to have a full-time gig. You know, I'm happy being adjunct and kind of fitting it in with all of my freelancing and stuff like that. And then other people who really do want to have that tenure track. You know, having been on both sides of the equation, I mean, what are the drawbacks and the advantages of either of those scenarios?
Right. So people who, you know, there's two kind of paths to this. One is you go through school and you get your DMA and then you apply for full-time jobs and you start out as assistant professor and then go to associate and then full professor. And it takes you a number of years and you know, maybe you change institutions two or three times within the course of that career and you're mainly a teacher. And your playing career is kind of, you know, you do some playing, but it's not necessarily your focus, right? And so I did the opposite. I mainly played for a number of years in the DC area, and I did a lot with, you know, I started a group called the Washington Symphonic Brass, and I played, I had 1 year with the National Symphony and the Kennedy Center Opera House Orchestra, and then I landed a full-time job in the Baltimore Symphony. And once I got that, I realized that's not what I wanted. I loved working in different scenarios and doing different things. And coinciding with my son going to RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology, my youngest child, I thought, well, I've got an opportunity here. I can go wherever I want and do whatever I want. So I started applying for full-time tenure track positions. And even though I only had a master's, they accepted my experience as valuable enough to start me on here at the Hart School as associate professor. And then that was 6 years ago. And then I just recently got my full professor and tenure.
Awesome. Awesome. So what do you see as being the big difference between living in the Hartford area and being in the Beltway?
Yeah. So I tell people that my commute used to be 8 miles an hour or 80 miles an hour. And at least two or three people would have tried to kill me. And my commute was anywhere between a half an hour and 3 hours. And now my commute is 35 miles an hour for 30 minutes through these little New England towns. And then I'm at school. And then I get out of the car and I'm there. So I actually love it here. New England, I had never really spent much time in New England, but I love it. It's really awesome. I live on 4 acres off of 100 acres of state forest. And I've kind of landed in a fortuitous place.
Oh, that's good. Plenty of space to practice.
Right. And then I'm 2 hours from New York and 2 hours from Boston. So the other thing that's happened since I've been here is I started playing extra with the Boston Symphony. And we're actually going on a Japanese tour in November, playing Alpine Symphony and Mahler 6 and some great things. So I'm fortunate enough to be asked to play with them every now and then, and I'm enjoying that.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, that's kind of what I love about the area that I'm in here in South Central Pennsylvania. I don't know why they call it Central Pennsylvania. It's not central at all. But, being, an hour and 45 minutes from Philly, an hour and 45 minutes to Baltimore, a couple hours to D.C., could be in New York in a couple hours by train. It's great. It's all of the benefits of the large markets without the financial drawbacks that come with living in those areas in terms of, your basic cost of living. And then obviously the stress from driving, because I've done the Beltway way too many times as well. So
you and me both.
Did you do any mouthpiece buzzing while you were on the Beltway?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. In effect, there was a whole period where I would warm up on my way, like in the car when there's traffic. I just, drive with one hand and warm up with the other. And somebody wrote in to a newspaper, to the Washington Post one time, to Dr. Gridlock, and said, I saw a guy practicing trumpet and that was me. So I stopped doing that.
Yeah, well, don't try this at home.
Lately. Don't try this at home. No, I don't recommend that.
I've done some crazy stuff like that too. I used to actually driving back and forth between Harrisburg and Lancaster when I was making a transition to moving here. I used to take my piccolo trumpet along with me and just play long tones on that as I was making the 45 minute drive at 11 o'clock at night. So yeah, been there, done that. So yeah.
That's awesome. You did it at night though, where nobody could see you. I was stupid. I just did it in the daylight.
Yeah, that too. I sometimes like doing things like Melfi's buzzing in the car, just free buzzing, and then you pull up along somebody at a light, and they look at you like, who is this person and what are they doing? So, we're trumpet players, what can we say? Let's talk about your current position. One of the things you said, you made that transition kind of going from the playing and more playing and adjunct positions to now being more in that tenure track position. So obviously, teaching is an important thing to you. I mean, this is something that is definitely high on your priority list. So what is it about teaching that invigorates you?
I think what we have to realize is, especially at the collegiate level, we're not just teaching trumpet. We're their counselor and their mother and father and dog all wrapped up in one. And they're away from all those things, right? So we're it. And we're the applied teacher that attracted them to that institution. And we're the most important person in their lives in many ways. And so we have to kind of take care of that relationship and make sure they're doing okay. And so the other thing I tell people is I'm not just training them to play the trumpet. What we learn in the studio and as a trumpet performance major or an education major or whatever you happen to be is very applicable to all kinds of fields. I have a friend that I knew in Chicago. His name was Wally Hamburg, and he was a trumpet player, very good trumpet player. And he got tired of playing the trumpet for a living and applied to law school. And now he's a really successful lawyer. And all the things he learned in music school were applicable to his LSAT that he took and his law degree, and now is a lawyer. So, the accountability we learn as musicians, instant accountability. Like, not too many professions have, like, okay, I'm going to do this, and it's you're instantly going to know whether I suck or not. That's very unusual. I think other professions, you sit in classroom and listen to your lecture, and you do your homework and tests and everything, and it's more of a under the table accountability. Like, okay, I got a C on this. I need to work on this. Blah blah blah. But when we play every week in studio class, it's apparent. Hey, you guys are getting better, or maybe somebody's not, right? And so that motivation and that transference to other fields where you're going to maybe be in the business world and, oh, I've got to really perform here because this is my job. It's amazing how many people in the business world actually don't do their job in the world in general. And as a musician, you know instantly whether the person's done their job or not. That instant accountability is so rare in the business world. I think we do really well when we get out there, us musicians.
Yeah. What are some of the other skills that you think that have kind of this almost better than one-to-one correlation?
Right. Teaching yourself how to do something new and solving problems. So you're in the practice room at 11 o'clock at night, and Professor Snedeker, that would be me, told you to play, the Longinati hexaphonic study, and you got to go, and you can't even come close to doing that. You got to sit there, just you and yourself, and figure it out. How you I might have given you some tools. You might be able to get some tools on the internet, but pretty much you're stuck with this problem to solve, and you do it. You either do it or you don't, but you eventually do it. And most of my students figure it out. And so that's very similar to computer programmers. Here's a problem. You got to get the computer to do this. You've got to write code to do this. That's the same thing. Like, so my son, he's a computer engineer, and he has to write firmware for these chips. And he they give him a problem. Here, go. And he's got to figure it out. So that's a very, as you say, one-to-one correlation, in my opinion.
Well, essentially, we've got like two types of thinking when it comes to our focus and our attention. Things like there's convergent thinking and divergent thinking. And convergent thinking is like, focus on the problem. And then the divergent is kind of like, seeing the bigger picture. And I think that music has a really interesting mix where you have to be, you have to have that convergent thinking. You have to be like super focused on some technical aspects and execution and things like that, your time, all of these things that have to occur for it to be a great performance. But then you also have to have the divergent thinking, the creative thinking that goes along with it. You know, whether it's in the problem solving portions of your development, or you know, like if you're especially like if you're a jazz player, if you have to improvise or things like that. So and even in the classical world, where you know, you don't 100% know what the conductor is going to do at any given point in time. You know, something might change a little
bit, and you usually don't.
So you have to find that balance between being able to be fixed on the track and then be able to shift when necessary. And I think that's a skill that's really missing with people and that we get as musicians.
Well, you just said one of my favorite words is balance. I mean, my job as a teacher is to help these students find their balance. And so many adults don't have that, right? They don't have a balance in their personal life or their professional life or anything, they're struggling with that. And I think if you can help a student find their balance in college, it really helps you with everything in life. And I like being part of that. So, you know, twice a year we have these big get-togethers with all the brass players. I do a brisket in the smoker and you know, the kids go hiking. And I try to create this culture of, hey, we're all here for each other. And my student studio is normally about half grad students, half undergrads. There's a little more undergrads this year, but I like that mix because the grad students kind of take the undergrads under their wing and it becomes bigger than me. So that's what's been happening in my studio, is that it's all kind of running itself now because of the expectations I've set up in the last 6 years. So that's nice to see. And that's similar to how I studied with Barbara Butler and Charlie Geyer at Eastman back in the day. And I was at school with Byron Stripling and Jim Wilt and Doug Prosser and these great players. And we kind of, you know, it ran itself as well. I mean, the expectations were very high. They were set at the top with Barb and Charlie, and we knew what was expected. And we kind of did our own thing in the way that was expected. And that's what's starting to happen. It wasn't that way when I got here, but now it's starting to get that way. And I like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like if you had to draw kind of these standard situations, people tend to become teachers because either A, they've had really, really great teachers. I didn't study with Barbara or with Charlie, but I certainly know plenty of people who have, and their accomplishments speak for themselves. So you have people like that who inspire you to be great teachers. And then they also have the opposite end of the spectrum, which is a lot of people get into teaching because they've had horrible teachers and they want to contribute to the world and make sure that no one has to go through the crap that they had to go through. So, you know, but definitely like with Eastman, you not only have some of the greatest teachers in the world there, you have some of the greatest players in the world there that are studying alongside of you. So when you're in that mix, when you're with someone like a Byron, who's just, you know, one of my favorite players, that is on the scene today, you know, is there a lot of, or was there a lot of mutual support for each other, like the encouragement, the kind of setting, you know, like, you know, helping to lift each other up, or was it a lot of, and it's not an either or, I guess, a lot of, oh crap, he's doing that. I better get my ass in the practice room and catch up.
Well, of course there's both. I mean, the first time I heard Byron play, they were doing something called the Trumpet All-Stars Concert. I was a freshman and he was, I don't know, junior or senior, but he was already playing in Ray Wright's ensemble. And they had this Trumpet All-Stars things where they had Alan Vizzuti, Lou Soloff, Vinny DiMartino, and Jeff Tysick, who at the time was making a solo career. And so those four Eastman, former Eastman people, were fronting the Eastman Jazz Ensemble, and Byron was playing split lead. And I remember thinking, oh my God, where have I landed? This is unbelievable. So he was very inspiring that way, but he also kind of, he became a really good friend. And I remember very distinctly, I was working on this Telemann flute fantasia on piccolo trumpet in the next practice room with him. And he came over and goes, "Hey man, that sounds great. What are you doing? What is that?" He was very interested in what I was doing. And I was just this little freshman, you know, trying to practice piccolo trumpet. And he was very supportive. And of course, I, you know, thought he was amazing of all the things he did. And he and I have kept in touch. And he's a good human, too. I think that's the other thing I like about what Barb and Charlie did. And what I try to do with my studio is realize that we're not just trying to be great players and, you know, be better than the other person. We're trying to be there for each other and be good citizens of this planet rather than just good trumpet players.
Yeah. Well, that says it all right there, actually. I think so many times we become so tied up in our identity is based on what we do, regardless of whether it's in music or any other area in life. It's, you know, you become you base who you are off of what you're doing as opposed to who you truly are. And, you know, all the skill in the world and all the talent in the world, if you're a jerk, you know, it's kind of hard to make things work for you in the long haul, you know.
I agree.
Yeah.
So although we all know people that make that work for them and they think, how is that working for them? And you always think they're going to get they deserve, but they never do. But you got to just walk past that.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the outliers, you know, always the outliers, but, and who knows, they could be even more successful if they weren't such pains in the butt.
So. That's right. So I think being a good human first is always a good policy. And the worst that could happen is you could be a good person.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, in terms of your approach to teaching, one of my martial arts teachers, she said something kind of stuck in my head, which was, you come to class to learn what to practice and how to practice, and practice is what you do at home. And that stuck on me. It stuck in my head and in my heart. And so as a teacher, I've always tried to instill not only the technical aspect of, you know, this is how you do something specifically, but also kind of the psychological perspective of this is the way that you should approach problem solving. This is the way that you should think about your problems and come to creative solutions. So, you know, setting my students up for the best possible success. So for you in the classroom and in your studio, do you have kind of a framework that you use to teach your students how to become their own best teachers?
Right. No, that's a great question. And yeah, so I when I studied with Charlie, he would always come at everything from a musical standpoint. Like no matter what I was working on, whether it was articulation or a range or sound or whatever, he would always try to do it through music. And that's what I try to do. In fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote my book. Later in my career or my early career, I studied with Arnold Jacobs and Bud Herseth. And so I've had no lack of amazing teachers and mentors in my life. But I wrote the book because I thought, first of all, I loved Charlier number two, okay? But I didn't love the whole Charlier book because I thought it got into this thing where it was a lot of work for anyway, I was beating my face up. So I thought, how about if I just write a whole book of Charlier number twos? I wonder if people would like that. And they did. And so I was able to tap into a need there, which we'll talk about later. But as far as what I try to do with my students, if they're working on something technical, I try to solve it musically because music's got to always be the motivation. And in studio class the other day, we define music as tension and release through emotion. And so that's just one way to define it. But what I mean by that is you can't just play the notes, right? You've got to go somewhere or away from something, and you've got to convey emotion through that, right? So you can take any technical passage and slow it down and do that like crazy, right? You can make all the music in the world taking things at 1/16th tempo and practice the song. I think about, I tell people to learn the song, which means if it goes, right, you have to hear those intervals, and begin to hear that melody. I don't care how complicated it is, you can slow it down and learn the song. And once they do that, it doesn't matter how crazy the 12-tone piece is or how crazy. And so with that philosophy, I've actually been able to teach my students most of the Charliers, that the ones, the hard ones that I didn't like practicing with Charlie. And I think if you slow it down and think music, which is direction and conveying emotion, you can play anything. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
No, that's great. Actually, that sets me up for another question, which is, like with all of your years of experience and all the students that you've taught, have you detected any theme in terms of like the common faults that students have as they're coming into a music program, the things that you kind of have to work the hardest to get them to readjust their approach on?
Yeah, the number one thing is they haven't done enough listening. They have no idea what they listen to. They take their phone and they search for something on Spotify or YouTube. And when you say, in fact, I just kind of went honey badger last night in studio class about this. I'm like, you guys don't have time not to listen. And here, and so I played some of my heroes. It was my hero talk. So I played Maurice André and I played, you know, Harry Glantz, and I played Louis Armstrong, and I played just a bunch of people. And I played Alison Balsam, and I played all these people. And I'm like, you need to know these people. You need to not only know their names, but what's their background? How did they get to where they are? Because I sure as hell knew where Bud came from early on. And I knew about Maurice André early on, like in eighth and ninth grade. And I hero worship those people because I wanted to even come close to getting something, some semblance of what they had. And you guys are just listening to anything on your phone. You don't even know who you're listening to. So you gotta, you know, have your heroes on your phone. And that's severely lacking in today's world, because it's ironic that more access to information means getting less information.
Yeah.
Right? I don't even know how that worked, but that's the reality, is they have less information because they have access to more information.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. I mean, there's the breadth of information, and it's, no one seems, because we're kind of constantly inundated by this new information, it's hard to dive down deep and get the essence of stuff. And I always think back, I mean, having grown up in the age of LPs, that's one of the things that I miss the most. You know, when I hear somebody great, when I hear something that really excites me, it used to be, and I can get to the whole thing of how the dopamine works in your brain, the reward system, reward network system and all that sort of stuff. It's the anticipation of it, and how excited I would get about, oh, I just heard this new trumpet player and I want to go check it out. And I'll have to go to the music store, the record store, and find a record and take it home and open it up and put it on the turntable. And as I'm listening, holding the album and reading the liner notes. And it was a total sensory experience.
You're preaching to the choir, man, but that makes us sound old, because that doesn't happen anymore.
Right. And that's what I miss the most, though, because all of that time spent doing that helped me to develop a knowledge of not just the music and the musicians, but also to have a greater context of what's going on culturally and specifically in the music scene. You start to see, familiar names. You start to see, this person, this is the arranger, this is the composer, this is the engineer, and you start to be able to put things together and create a fuller narrative as opposed to just these sound bites, basically. And I think that is a big loss for people, because they don't know how to get down those rabbit holes that we found ourselves in so often. You pick up this album and you go, oh, wow, I have to look at this next thing and where does it lead me on this path? So, obviously you said you went honey badger on them, but, is that something that you feel that you need to become much more aware of as you're working with with your students going forward? And is this something that that teachers that are out there right now, regardless of whether they're teaching in secondary or college or postgraduate classes, need to really become more aware of how they instill this desire to go deeper into the music?
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Well, I think starting out by playing them your heroes is the first step, right? So don't assume they're doing the listening. Go out and, like I did last night, play some of your heroes. Hey, I'm excited about this. Here's Mahler 5 with Hirschfeld playing under George Schulte, and tell them about, as I did last night, about literally wearing out two sets of cassettes that I had recorded from the album in my car. So I'd play it everywhere I drove in high school because I was so excited about this, and I knew it backwards and forwards before I ever played Mahler 5, right? And so that's what I got excited about. And if you're excited about it, they'll find something to be excited about it. So I'd say a small fraction of my studio right now does great listening. Like, they bring things to me and to the rest of the group that it's like, wow, where did you find that? That's amazing. And then a big portion of them don't do hardly any listening because they feel like they're too busy. But if you kind of show them the way, hey, here are a few artists I like. Go find the people that you like and bring it to us and give them that assignment. I think that's the first step, right? And just show them how to do that. And you can do it online, but and all the information that you talked about in the album cover, it's all there. You just have to find it. It's a little more challenging, but they're good at that. If they really want to find who Steve Epstein is, the producer, they'll figure it out. I was on Carnival CD with Wynton, right? When Wynton made that Cornet album in the 1980s with the Eastman Wind Ensemble, and Don Hunsberger did all these new arrangements of the Herbert L. Clark and Arban Cornet solos, I was on that as a student. And it was great to hear all the things that Wynton was listening to at the time. And then, of course, Steve Epstein, the great producer from CBS Masterworks, was it CBS Masterworks? He was the producer on that. And then I started reading about this guy. I was like, wow. And so then I went and found other albums that Steve Epstein had produced and realized that this guy really knows what he's doing. As far as classical ensembles, this guy has done it all. So it's a long way of saying that, yes, you can inspire that in your students. You just have to let them know it's important. Sometimes it might be assigning them a listening. But then getting that as a habit of way of life, and way of life is not far behind if you show them it's important.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, I mean, you mentioned Bud and Maurice as being some of your heroes, Alison Balsam. But who are some of the newer faces in the trumpet world that, you know, bear giving like some serious listening energy to?
That's a good question. Well, I don't know how long Allison's been around. I just recently discovered her in the last 5 years. So, I mean, but she's been around for longer than that. There's a gentleman, and I haven't heard him play, but he's setting the world on fire. A guy that just recently got principal trumpet in the Nashville Symphony.
William Leathers.
Bill Weathers. Leathers, yes. William Leathers. And I hear he's terrific as far as classical playing. I don't think he does solo albums, but he probably will. There's a lot of people up and coming that are ready to set the world on fire. I'm drawing a blank right now. I know there's people I've been listening to that have that are not, you know, decades old, but I'll think of it in a minute. But yes, there's always stuff to listen to, and my students bring me things all the time that's like, wow, listen to that.
Yeah, well, there's never a shortage of new up and coming talent, and you know, it, it's I think it's always just interesting to compare, not necessarily in a competition kind of way, but you know, compare the advances and advancements that have gone on in terms of our abilities, because I think it's just like in athletics, physical abilities begin to change, and things that at one point you know people thought were impossible are now becoming commonplace. And so we're seeing this great level of what Nini would call virtuoso level students coming out of these great programs, places like Eastman and Berkeley and Juilliard and things like that. So we're getting these young players that just have phenomenal technical abilities. So it's interesting to see how that changes, but you know, the thing that to me sometimes I feel gets lost in the sauce is the soul, the music. You know,
I totally agree. I mean, one of the reasons I'm having trouble coming up with somebody I'm super excited about that's just out of school is that most of the students, and I know that I'll get some grief about this, but most of the top students coming out of music schools these days don't really do anything for me. They're like, wow, that's technically really cool. That person's probably a better trumpet player than me, but they're not really talking to me. They're not speaking to me. And when I listen to, you know, some top players today, that's kind of, I'm sorry, that's what I feel. I feel like they're not, that their prime goal is not to convey the music, it's to play the right notes. And that's kind of the fault of music in general, because that's what we've been valuing over the year, the past decade or so, is that, you know, the audition has geared people toward that. It's like, play all the right notes, be perfect, perfect playing, you know, let's make it sound like the CD. And they're not looking for the music first. They're looking for the technical things first. And I think that's wrong. I think, you know, and it, I got to say too, sometimes it makes orchestras boring. Okay. So, even some orchestras that shouldn't be boring or didn't used to be boring, sometimes they're boring because it's just like, okay, you know, hit me with something that I'm really going to remember, and they don't. So I will say, and it's not just because I'm working with them, but I will say that Boston's different because that brass section in particular with Toby Oft and Tom Rawls and Mike Roylance and Gus Sebring and some really world-class brass players, I listen to them and I get excited. They did a Poem of Ecstasy not too long ago, and I just was like, I brought my students. I was jumping out of my seat. We did Alpine Symphony some months ago. We're taking Alpine Symphony to Japan. They're like on it. They it's like you can tell they're not afraid of missing notes. They're just going to go. And they don't miss notes necessarily, but they go for it, and they make you jump out of your seat. And you're like, wow, that's, in my opinion, and again, I'll probably get grief about it, but it's one of the best brass play sections playing today is that orchestra. And some of it's the hall is so exciting because they're in Symphony Hall in Boston. It's one of the best halls in the world. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm with you on that. There's certainly something to be said for a note perfect performance. You know, I guess
I don't know what you're going to say about it other than it's note perfect, because I don't care, frankly.
I mean, I would much rather, you know, hear some cuffs and some gaffs and have like pure emotion coming through the music than anything, you know. So
when I listen to jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton at the helm, I hear all those guys playing music pretty much all the time. As opposed to, again, some newer ensembles, I feel like they're just playing the notes. And I don't know. I mean, again, that's a generalization, and it's probably a bad one, but I'll listen to Wynton all day long. I think he's awesome. And what he inspires in that orchestra is exceptional.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talk about heroes. You know, Wynton is one of those guys that has kind of transcended the musical scene, you know, proving that you can be a great trumpet player in a variety of genres and be so inspirational and so passionate about what you do. So yeah, he's definitely an interesting cat.
Well, Whitten's not just a Trump player. He's a cultural leader in our world right now, and he embraces that. And you know, I can't say enough about the energies he put into that and the positive change he's made possible through his activities.
Well, you know, music is it's such an important part of our society, the global society. I'm not just talking about, you know, here in the U.S., but...
You say that, but tell that to the school boards across this country that are canceling music programs left and right.
I know. I can't preach to the choir on that one for sure.
Right. I mean, you can say it's important, but getting the people that make the decisions to believe that is, I think we're incredibly misguided in this country in our priorities.
Well, yeah, I was actually having a conversation with someone earlier today, and it had nothing about music, but it was very similar. It's, you know, when you're when you know something is important and you need it. I was talking about stress reduction, saying, you know, all these people talk about how they want stress reduction classes, but they say they're too busy to do the class. Which is like, okay, well, so basically you're saying what you need is exactly what you're avoiding doing. And, you know, music is the same way. You know, music can, in the educational process, can be so beneficial, and the cultural processes, it can be so beneficial, but you have to acknowledge it. And then you have to, more than acknowledge, you have to act on it. And,
So getting back to the whole listening thing, which I think is, you asked me about what's lacking in today's students, that to me is job number one, is getting them to listen. But what better stress reduction than putting on something that they feel in their soul that so much that they're majoring in it, and sitting out and just listening? Don't worry about looking at the music. Don't get your part out and mark it. I mean, that's for later. Just sit down and listen. And maybe have a few friends over and listen. I remember staying up till 2-3 in the morning at Eastman with Byron and Kurt and Dave Glasser and those guys, listening to Louis Armstrong and Thelonious Monk. And you know, at that time, Wynton was coming up. So we'd be listening to him when he was with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. And still to this day, one of my favorite albums is Straight No Chaser with Art Blakey when Wynton was like 22. And he's killing it on that. And... talk about a record that I wore out. I just didn't think playing like that was possible. So every time I listened to that, it got me not only excited about music, but it was a stress reduction for me. That was my therapy, is going and hanging with those guys and listening to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, folks. Listen. Listen to Phil. Let's go back and talk about your writing a little bit. You said that your inspiration to write came out of that wonderful Charlie A2. Do you view what you've done with your books as being kind of to fill? Are you feeling like you're filling a gap that's existing in the current publications, or are you just trying to blaze your own path, as it were?
That's a good question. I think when I wrote the first book in 1993, I definitely filled a gap. These days, there's a lot of books out there. Like, there's so many etude books out there. And I don't know if you know Q Publications, Q Press, with Tim Quinlan, I think is his name. And he's not only putting a lot of new books out, but reissuing old books like Mel Broyles and Vacchiano and all the, and Harry Glantz wrote a book, and Doc Schutzer wrote a book, and every trumpet player, it seems, has written a book. But when I was in school, I didn't see those books, and because they weren't really widely available. You know, we got the Charlier and the Top Tones and the Longinati and, you know, the standards. But I think one gap that I filled was this lyrical thing, right? I never forget going to that first International Trumpet Guild conference in 1993 with a box of my books that Robert King printed up. Robert King was my distributor, and we had 500 of them. And they just, they went like crazy because people open them up and go, oh, I can play this right now. There's nothing in this I can't do. And it doesn't matter what level of player I am. Now, there's some challenges in it to do it really amazing. I mean, I put it in the hands of, you know, Tom Rawls, and it's one thing, and you put it together in a hands of a freshman in college, and it's another thing. But both of them can play the notes, right? And so that's, as opposed to, you know, getting through a Top Tones or a Vern Reynolds or even one of the harder Charliers, or any of the Charliers, really, it's much more daunting a task. So mine were relatively easy, but you could learn a lot from the phrasing of those. And so I've since written volume 2 of the lyrical etudes, and then I've written some opera etudes inspired by my years at Washington National Opera. And then recently during COVID, I wrote this thing called lyrical orchestral etudes, which are things like the Shostakovich Piano Concerto and, you know, Pines of Rome and things like that. Lyrical excerpts, but I write etudes on them. So they're not the excerpt, they're the etudes based on it, based on like outdoor overture or things like that.
Yeah. Sounds very, very cool.
Yeah. So I think I try to fill gaps, but I don't think anybody needs any more etude books out there. It's just a matter of what works for you. I just keep writing them because I've got kind of a market now and people still buy them. I just wrote a euphonium book. Years ago, I wrote a tuba etude book, which is kind of funny because that's on a lot of college audition lists and military band lists. And so tuba players know me as the guy that wrote the low etudes for tuba. And I meet these tuba players and they give me this funny look. It's like, what is that in your hand? Is that a trumpet? Wait, you're the guy that, yeah. It's like, yeah. He goes, and they get mad. They get mad that I don't play tuba because I'm writing like 5 ledger line C's for them all over the place. And they're having to learn this. And they think, well, I'm going to do it because this guy can do it. And then they find out I'm a trumpet player.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But in answer to your question about writing, I didn't train as a composer. So the only thing I have in my arsenal is my imagination. And so I imagine what would it be like to write a collection of melodies. And I did it. And then for the tuba book, same thing. What's it like to play the tuba down there? Wow. In Prokofiev 5, they have these big, you know, 5 ledger line C's. And it's like, looks like a second grader did it with a crayon. They can barely read it, right? But they have to play down there. Oh, I'm going to fill this gap by writing a book that has those notes down there. I had to learn a whole different language and use my imagination. What's it like to play down there? Okay. I had to visualize what's it like to play the tuba down there to get something doable for them. So it's the same for all of us that maybe write for piano that don't play for piano. You have to imagine, can I reach this, right? And so imagination's our strongest tool, whether for any musician.
Yeah. Well, and I think the one thing that is definitely working in your favor, from my observation, is that, as you said earlier, you approach everything in terms of music. And, you know, I know a lot of people who are talented writers and arrangers and things like that. And not getting into voice leading and stuff like that, but they write stuff that just not only is it difficult to play in terms of maybe the intervallic nature, the rhythmic nature, but it just doesn't make sense musically. And if I can make sense of something musically, I'll figure out how to play it. If it doesn't make any musical sense, then I'm just going to really struggle with it. So I think anytime you approach things from that musical perspective, either melodically or rhythmically, you know, definitely both, that it's going to be a much better product because the end product is already in mind.
You know what's been our worst enemy in that is the computer, right? Because the arrangers and the composers have their computer and they input these notes that they think might sound good. And the computer plays it perfectly. And then they think, well, somebody else can play this perfectly. And they don't realize the challenges of that. Whereas back in the day, so I studied arranging with Ray Wright at Eastman, who was before that, he was with Radio City Music Hall. And we didn't have computers that could do this. We had big Judy Greene music sheets, you know, remember the big old tablets, and you took your pencil and you, you scribbled out your score, and then you wrote out parts at till 2 or 3 in the morning, and then you showed up to your ranging class where there was maybe a band or either a big band or a combo, and we played it the next day. And you had to imagine what it's going to be like for these guys to play these charts that you just wrote. And there was no computer feedback. You had to imagine that. And you had, I remember looking through like the tenor parts, second tenor. Yeah, how's this person going to, is this person going to kill me? You know, fourth trumpet, third trombone. Like, let's make sure that those lines all made sense. Even if they make sense within the vertical harmony, do they make sense this way, right? And that's what, that's in my opinion, I've played a lot of lame arrangements in my day. That's what those things are missing. They're missing the sense, the musical line within the inner parts.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember learning that lesson, you should be able to take any of the parts and play them individually, and it should make some musical sense. You know, if it's just dot, 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 you know, the same note, it's not music. You know, you're doing filler there. Right. Always try to make a part interesting for every player. So I like that. So when, you know, with your fascination with Charlie A, or your dis...
I don't know about that.
This fascination with Charlie. I mean, you know, Charlie A being, and I will admit, I have never played a Charlie A etude in my life, and probably will never. But
you should. You like it more than you think.
I'm sure I will. I actually need to just get your first book, and I'll play that.
So okay,
we'll settle on that.
I'll send it to you.
So, you know, Charlie A being, one of the classic method books, you know, and then I mean, Arbenz and Clark and, you know, we can go on and on and on some of the more classic method books. But, you know, what you were saying about the availability of them, there's a time when they weren't as available, now they are. But the foundational skills, I think, will never die. The demands of the current player, I think, have perhaps changed so that there has to be a slight variation or some addition to that, the methodology that exists. So with that in mind, what are some of the areas that you see as being needing a little bit extra love in terms of some of the method books or the teaching methods that are out there?
Are you talking in the classical world, the jazz world, the show world, or all of the above?
You pick it. in general.
First of all, if you can get through the whole Charlie A book, you're doing pretty well. Even by today's standards, like that Wagner one, like 34, whatever that is, that has all the themes from Wagner and then ends toward the end, you have Parsifal. If you can get through that, you can get through anything. And top tones, that's, you know, Hirschfeld used to play through the top tone book, and he said if he could get to number 7 without starting to get tired, he was in shape. You know, most of us can't get through one of those without dying. Have you ever played that book, Top Tones, Walter Smith?
I think, played 1 or 2 out of there.
Yeah. I mean, they're not great pieces of music, but they're very challenging for the trumpet player. So I don't think we need to write any harder stuff. I think what tends to go by the wayside with the old books is just basic production. Basic, how securely can you start a note? Loud, soft, high, or low? How can you be secure on your instrument just from a production standpoint? How beautiful a sound can you make? And so that's not necessarily writing the books. One of the people that actually is writing books right now that's addressing these is Chris Gecker. Do you know his books at all?
I am not familiar with his books. I do know who Chris is.
Yeah, so he has articulation books. He has a number of things that address some technical needs, and they're good. So I use those with my students. But as far as... The old school books with Charlie A and stuff, there's almost too much material out there. There always has been. And for me as a student at Eastman, I remember Charlie had me buy 7 etude books, and pretty much every week we would have 7 etudes that we had to deal with, right? there was a, Vern Reynolds wrote this book that was almost impossible for me to play, but it was this atonal book. We had one of those, a Charlier, a Top Tones, a Longinati, a Biche. You ever heard of the Biche book? Marcel Biche, and there was another couple, and I had to deal with all those plus solos and excerpts. So it was a lot. And for the now, when I go back and I like, you know, during COVID, Håkon Hagenberger, every Monday he would drop one of those Charliers, right? Have you heard him do those?
Oh yeah,
yeah. So when I met him this summer, I said, "Dude, I think I owe you a lot of money because every Monday during COVID, I studied with you, right?" Because I would literally just look forward to that. And then I'd get my Charlier book out and I'd have him play and I'd play back and forth and I'd study with him. Just, and he made new music out of those old etudes. So I don't think we need more etude books. I think we just need to pay more attention to how we play the old ones. It's not what you play, it's how you play it. And I think too many people, again, don't get through a whole Charlier. They just play the beginning and they're like, I kind of did that. And it's, again, it's just washing over them rather than them diving deep into what this is and what you're supposed to get out of it.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that, you know, I see as being, had been missing for a while, and people are addressing this, definitely leans more towards the fields that I play in more, which is, you know, jazz and commercial, where there aren't, or there hadn't been a whole lot of stuff that was written with the tonalities that you have to deal with if you're playing a lot of jazz or if you're playing a lot of pop music or you're playing a lot of show tunes. So some of the people who are writing books and doing etudes and things that are geared towards the jazz and the commercial player, I think that's kind of a niche that needed to be addressed. Just so you can get the sounds in your head, you know.
Right. I agree. So like, what books do you like on those and that front?
Pat Harbison did a really great take on Clark, and just going through all the the Clark II study, but just doing it in different modes, you know. So instead of just playing it in major, you're going to play it in, you know, Dorian and Lydian and Mixolydian, and you know just being able to hear those tonalities and get those patterns under your fingers. It's not necessarily a jazz book or commercial book, but like Scott Belk's Lip Flexibilities, which, you know, take a slightly off-center turn of standard flexibility studies. So a little more melodically interesting concepts that sit with the modern listener, the modern player's ears. So, I mean, I like things like that. Those are kind of like some of my standard.
I don't know. So as far as shows are concerned, do you know who Paul Barron is?
Yeah.
Paul. He's got a Broadway book out that's kind of a Broadway excerpt book. And he talks about some of the skills necessary. I bought that book. I think it's great. I think I make my students all do a rotation in the Broadway show. We have a really great theater department here. And they have to play in the pit orchestra for a rotation as part of their education, right? I think getting exposure to all styles of music is a necessity in today's world, right? You can't get out of music school without learning how to swing on some level, right? And play commercial, you know, whether it's rock or you know, bassy style jazz or you know, whatever. You've got to be able to switch gears and do something like that, because even if you're principal trumpet in some major, when I was in the Baltimore Symphony, we did a lot of pops, right? And I ended up, you know, doing a lot of things. I took some jazz solos that were, I got a great story. You know who Patty Austin is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so she brought her little trio and in front of the Baltimore Symphony, and there was this tune with a second trumpet had a solo. And so it was, you know, changes, and I took some courses at Eastman, but I suck at changes. So I wrote out what was on her album that her trumpet player had played. And so I stood up and played that solo, and the whole band turned around and looked at me like, "You're playing the exact same solo?" I'm like, "Sorry, that's what you get." But I sounded good because it was that dude's solo that was on her album, right? I just wanted to sound good, and I could play that solo, right? Probably should have made something else up, but that's what I did, and it was kind of funny that they instantly recognized it. And she turned around and she goes, you know, you can play whatever you want. And I'm like, this is what I want to play.
Yeah, if there's a wrong note in there, it's not my fault. It's whoever played that.
But I could sound like that guy. I mean, I could convincingly sound like that person. And so whether it's a written out solo or it's changes and I just write something out, I can sound like I know what I'm doing to the audience. And I think that's the important thing.
Yeah. Well, it's commitment, you know, and going back to, you know, kind of the, I think maybe the theme for our discussion today is it's the music and it's the emotion that is music.
You know? Right.
Once you take the emotion out of music, it stops being music as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. Totally.
So, well, that is too funny. So I have to see if I can find a recording of that somewhere.
Well, I don't think they recorded that concert, but you could buy her CD and listen to that solo. That's not me, but I played that solo.
I will imagine it's you.
Okay.
That's great. So, you know, with all of the different gigs that you've done, like, you know, with Baltimore, with the opera, what do you see, you know, in terms of like the demands of the playing? There are going to be different kind of scenarios. What do you find to be like the most enjoyable situation as far as you, you know, if you only had to pick one kind of music or one organization to play with, you know, what do you think that would be?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, the interesting thing is I found out what that was like when I played full time with Baltimore Symphony. I realized I didn't like it as much as I thought, because even though that was a fine orchestra, you know, I was used to leading the Washington Symphonic Brass and doing a lot of contracting contract for different events and, you know, do ballets and operas and jazz, you know, jazz type gigs. And I realized, wow, this is almost too easy as far as like I don't get to pick what I play here. I just play what's in front of me, which was, you know, formal. But I think the best scenario is you play with different people all the time and get to enjoy different people's musical language. And if you're in an orchestra that you sit next to the same people all year, that's the musical language you're immersed in. Now you have guest artists and then you have subs come in, but it's more fun. So last week I went and did a gig at the National Cathedral with the Washington Symphonic Brass, and I saw these people that I hadn't seen in a while, and we played some Copland and some Blanchard and some crazy stuff, and then we hung out afterwards, and that, to me, that's fun, seeing new people, right? And then before that, I was contracting a ballet at Wolf Trap. I'm still the orchestra contractor at Wolf Trap outside of D.C., so anytime there's an opera or a ballet or a show, I'll get the orchestra for that. And so I love putting together these different groups of people that play together, and maybe they haven't all played together in that configuration ever before, but I kind of know who to put together, and it's exciting to me. So to me, what I'm doing now is kind of the best of all possible worlds. Like, I get to go play with Boston every now and then, but then they say goodbye to me because they're tired of me by the time I'm done with my thing, and I get to go do something else. So nobody gets tired of you.
Yeah, there is that.
And you don't get tired. And so by the time you're comfortable in one situation, you put yourself in another. And isn't that what life's about? Like experiencing different people, different types of things, different cultures, different humans. And that's what we're talking about, right? And as opposed to, I think, again, I'll get grief for this, but if I were in the Chicago Symphony tomorrow, you'd be around the same people all year long, doing it, sitting in the same chair in the same hall, and every now and then you get to go on a tour. That's a really cool gig, but I don't think I would be as happy as what I'm doing now, which is every 4 years I get a complete different set of students. And, you know, soon the Boston Symphony will be tired of me and they'll stop calling me, and I'll go play extra for somebody else. That's, to me, that's fine. it's all about experiencing different people and experiencing different musical languages. And I love that.
Well, that's a great attitude to have. I dig it. All right. Well, Phil, we have a couple of standard segments that I do in every episode, and we're going to go ahead and get to our first one. And first one, these are easy. First one's called Sound Off, and it's brought to us by my good friend Michael Barkley of Barkley Microphones, and it's about your approach to sound. And I think the way I'd like to ask this question is as an educator, as someone who's helping to shape this next generation of trumpet players, how do you approach the concept of sound with your students in helping them to find their own unique and best sound?
All right. So I'll answer this by citing something Winton did several years ago, and that is he talked about his warm-up, and he just played a concert F, a G on his B-flat trumpet. And he said, I want to try to get as many different colors with this one note as I possibly can. And to me, that's the mark of a great musician, is to play one note and express a whole ton of things on one note. And so he did. I think that video is still out there, and check it out, because he takes a concert F, and it's just the most beautiful thing. And he weaves it in and out, and it's like 5 minutes, and he does a concert F. And it's amazing. So what I tell my students is, it doesn't matter what note you're playing, do something with the notes. Don't just sit on, don't be a computer, because a computer can play all your notes way better than you. What you have is you got to put some of your heart into the notes. So there's all kinds of sounds. Like, you know, I mean, Miles had one sound, Hirsch had another sound, Harry Glantz had another sound. They're all valid, but and Vacchiano, when I listen to Vacchiano, don't take this the wrong way, but I don't particularly like Vacchiano's sound. It's kind of nasal. It had some things that we don't have about our sound these days. It had some commitment to it that was unique. And so I could listen to Vacchiano for a long time because of it. But as far as, and you know, maybe it was the recording quality back then in the 1950s and 60s, but I love listening to Vacchiano, even though it's not my favorite sound, right? Maurice André, I think he's got an amazing sound. I love what he does, but it's very different than Hirsch or Winton or just about anybody. I mean, what I love is unique sounds. Used to listen to orchestras, and you could tell the Cleveland Orchestra because Bernie Adelstein was back there on, yeah, da 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 da. And then you could listen to Johnny Ware in the New York Philharmonic, and you could listen to Hirsch in the Chicago Symphony, and you could listen to Frank Kataravic in the Philadelphia Orchestra. And all those guys sounded different. Like, nobody sounded the same. And I think today people sound the same. So what I try to do is tell people, okay, you got to learn the audition. And in the audition, you got to kind of sound like everybody else, just good. But have your own unique sound that you are cultivating so that when you get the job, you can be a personality and you connect with your audience in a way that's maybe not happening today. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Well, that's a great answer. That question can go down so many different paths, but I like what you said about, get the gig and then make sure you put that personality into it. And I've had this conversation with a number of people on this podcast and off this podcast about how sound, particularly in the orchestral world, has become somewhat homogenized. And, you know, it's a good sound in terms of, the textbook sound, but the personality is just kind of goes away.
I know. I know. And all orchestras are going that way these days, unfortunately, because I think the audition process has cultivated that, unfortunately.
Yeah. You are not the first person that I've heard say that. So let's hope someone out there hears that and doesn't, well, if they get upset and change things, then that would be a good thing. But, I think that there's certainly is plenty of room in the world for those unique voices. And
they're sorely needed, in my opinion. I mean, it's not just room. We can't survive without it. What the arts organizations are not realizing is that unless you have personalities in these orchestras, you're not going to get your audience back. This post-COVID world, people want to go see something real that they're excited about. And if they're going to take a chance and go out again, you got to give them something more than the notes. And so they've got to change. Otherwise, it's, you know, they're doomed. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned. I mean, there'll always be a subset of people that'll go listen in an orchestra. But as far as getting to the next level and surviving in a real way, you've got to put forth your personalities and cultivate that and celebrate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I am 100% behind you on that. All right, let's move on to our next segment. Our next segment is about every trumpet player's favorite topic, gear. And it's called Geared Up, and Geared Up is brought to us by Venture Mouthpieces, Venture, where technology, design, and craftsmanship intersect. Use the code TRUMPETGURUS21 to get 10% off your order. So obligatory conversation about gear, but again, let's put that Trumpet Guru spin on it. As the educator, you know, you are dealing with, as people are trying to develop their sound, develop their personality, get their technique together, sometimes that requires an equipment change. I think sometimes we approach it too haphazardly. What are the guiding principles that you try to impart on your students about the role of equipment and how to make an educated evaluation of what works and what would need to change to make their job that much easier?
Right. So if their equipment is playing extraordinarily out of tune, or if the pitch is bad and it's hard to basically get through all the registers easily, I definitely recommend an equipment change. I gear them towards something kind of mainstream because, in my opinion, I think if you go the extreme route, you're limiting yourself just because it's political. I used to play a Monette 2000 LT, and I played that for a lot of years, but it was politically charged. And I liked the sound on it, but I also realized I was still me if I played a Bach or Yamaha. So, you know, I play a lot with the Boston Symphony now. So I play extra with them. So I'm, you know, playing a Bach or I have a Yamaha I'm trying out. And I still think I sound like me. I need something that plays a tool. So you need something that has a decent sound and plays in tune. And beyond that, it's you. Right. I could give you five hammers and the way you hammer is going to be the same. Right. So it can be weighted different and you can make your life easier. But I think the extreme. So I'll give you an example. One of my students came in and she had a Yamaha and she said, I really don't like this horn. I said, well, you know, OK. And I played it. I was like, well, it's OK, but you can go trade it in. And so she went to an unnamed music store. I won't tell who it was. And they sold her a Courtois, a double belled Courtois. Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, There's an outside bell, an inside bell is this heavy thing. I was like, Jesus Christ, what is this thing? But she goes, oh, I like the sound. I'm like, okay, great. But, and it was making everything else harder. So for a year, I tried to talk her into retrading it in. And so she took it to my friend, Steve Johnson at Virtuosity, who traded it out. And I could still kiss him for that because he was able to sell her horn and get her, I don't know what he got her, either the like Bach or Yamaha or whatever, but something she could play with easier. And I think whatever tool is the easiest to deal with is what you need to play. So I play a Pickett mouthpiece that is very, very mainstream. Peter Pickett knows what he's doing. When I was transitioning from Monette equipment to more mainstream equipment, I went to Peter Pickett's place and say that five times and then played what I thought was, you know, good. And he kind of made me a mouthpiece that was even better and it was fine. I have some Shokis, I have some Yamahas, I have some Bachs. Just play something that's easy to play. That's mainly, and don't fight the intonation. If the intonation is weird, either get somebody to fix it or get another horn. Because the last thing you want to be doing is lipping notes everywhere. That'll kill you. That'll make you tired real fast.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I hear that. I feel it as well.
Right.
All right. We got one final segment. This is a fun one. This is the Robinson's Remedy Rapid Fire Round, brought to us by Robinson's Remedy, rapid relief for your sore and tired chops. The Rapid Fire Round is a series of questions that kind of go all over the place. There's no rhyme or reason.
I'm terrible at this, by the way. Just be forewarned.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We've had some pretty bad ones, but... we'll see if you get the award or be the worst rapid fire round participant. It's fun. You're gonna have fun with this. All right, so here we go. Phil, first question for you. Who's the biggest influence on your life that is not a trumpet player?
Oh, my mother.
Okay. What's your favorite book?
What's my favorite book? Right now, with Rudd side by side.
All right. What's the worst movie you've ever seen?
Manos, Hands of Time.
Haven't even heard of it?
That's the worst movie ever made by popular opinion. But all right. People that know that movie will think it's funny.
All right. If you were not a trumpet player, what would you want to be?
People ask me that all the time. I guess I would want to be a business owner, which I kind of am, but yeah, business owner.
What's your favorite drink?
Right now, Angel Envy Rye.
I have to tell you, I am not a huge fan of the rye. I love the bourbon. Not a huge fan of the rye.
Well, it's aged in rum barrels. I mean, you can't go wrong. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's true. I'll give you that. All right. So you've got that bottle of Angel's Envy rye, and you're going to have a dinner party. And at this dinner party, you can invite any three living people. Let's exclude, family, because they'd be there anyway. But any three people in the world can come and spend the evening with you. And who would you want to have there?
Barack Obama is number one. I've always wanted to meet him. And they have to be living.
Three living people.
Winton and I'll come up with it in a minute. Barack Obama, Winton, and... That's a hard one. My wife.
I'll give you that one. I'll give you that. Okay. Same party. You've got three additional chairs at your table, and they can be for any three people in history. So any three people no longer with us.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Harry Glantz, number one. I would love to sit down and talk to him. And these trumpet players are not trumpet players.
Any three people.
Abraham Lincoln and Desmond Tutu.
Ooh, okay, good dinner. Next question, lacquer, plated, or raw?
Plated, silver plated.
All right. What is your favorite quote?
If you can't say anything original, don't say it. So Ray Wright used to say, if you can't say anything new with your arrangement, don't do it. So if you can't say anything new, don't say it.
Okay. What is your greatest fear?
Wow, so many. I'll say global warming, destroying the world. For my kids, not for me, for my kids.
You could be granted one superpower. What would it be?
Oh, I'd love to fly. I need to fly.
All right.
That would be awesome. Can I have that at the end of this interview? Because I've been thinking about that ever since, you know, my daughter has a shirt called Where's My Flying Car?
Yeah. And we're supposed to have one by now.
That's right.
Yeah. What aspect of trumpet playing do you find to be the most overrated?
High notes.
All right. And what aspect do you think is the most underrated?
Immediate production.
You can go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice about music. What would it be?
Oh, wow. About music or trumpet playing? About music. Okay. Don't sweat the technique. Just play music. Just, you know, I always would sweat the technique and I would forget to play music sometimes.
Okay. And while you're back there, you're going to give your younger self one piece of advice about life.
Huh. Wait 24 hours before you do anything major in your life.
Good advice.
24-hour rule, man.
Sometimes it should be a 24-year rule.
It should be.
All right. Final question for you, Phil. What do you want your legacy to be?
That I was a good person. That says it all. I mean, that I was a friend to people and that I was a decent person.
Well, of all the legacies to have, I think that's the greatest one. You know,
which is surprisingly hard to do, actually, to be a good person all the time.
Yeah,
and I certainly don't succeed in that.
You got to have goals. Can you write an etude book on that?
Sure.
Okay. Etude book on being a good person.
That's right. I'll dedicate it to you.
All right. Thanks a lot. Well, I have really enjoyed our time together today and, getting to know you and really excited about diving into some of your etude books and maybe I should go buy a copy of Charlier at one point in my life.
It's public domain now, so you can just download it.
Oh, even better.
But I'll send you mine. Send me your address. I'll send you mine.
Oh, man, I would appreciate that. So thanks a lot, Phil. And thanks for joining us for this episode of the Trumpet Gurus Hang. As always, like, subscribe, share. If you have any questions, reach out to me. And if you want to learn more about Phil, his books, his work, links to his website are in the show notes. So please make sure you stay in contact with this man. He's got a lot of stuff going on. So thanks again. Peace and slide grease. We out.
Thanks
for hanging with us today. This podcast is all about creating deeper connections through our mutual love of music and the trumpet life. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast and also like and share this episode with a friend. We want to see the hang grow for show. Please support our sponsors and consider becoming a personal supporter of this podcast as well. Remember, for less than the price of a bottle of valve oil a month, you can keep this podcast moving smoothly. The Trumpet Gurus Hang is recorded at The Candy Factory, a co-working space and social club located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jose Johnson is the executive producer. Post-production editing is by Mitch Bowers. Our opening theme song was composed and performed by Lexi Signor. And our closing theme music comes courtesy of The Greatest Funeral Ever. Incidental music is by Ethan Swayze and Jose Johnson. Graphic design by Ann Kirby of The Sweet Corps. The Trumpet Gurus Hang podcast is produced in collaboration with the So Good Lancaster Media Group.